assignment is over for the 17th and 18th chapter of the book of Proverbs. And want to do a little bit of introductory comments, as so often is done. In the very beginning of the book of Proverbs, you'll begin to find words such as knowledge and understanding, and the fear of God is wisdom. And particularly, though it's mentioned other times during this series of lessons, I'd like to dwell upon the idea of the fear of the Lord as a part of this as we begin some of the thoughts. But I'd like to use the wording that is found over in the 111th Psalm and verse 10, the very last verse of that psalm, where the psalmist has indicated the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all they that do his commandments. His praise endureth forever. And I want to pause for a moment to just think with regard to the idea of the fear of the Lord. We might think of it in terms of standing in awe, in reverence. We might think in terms of it, as the case may warrant, of actually being in fear of the Lord. But of where that potentially leads us as we think in that direction. And it doesn't always have to apply with regard to those things that are spiritual. If I do not stand in awe with regard to the laws of the land, if I do not stand in awe as a student in school, if I do not stand in awe as a child being raised in the home by their parents, and I have no respect or awe for them, just how much in the way of obedience am I likely to give? Is it not going to be true that I will simply walk in my own way? And if it happens to coincide with what the authority, whether it be teacher or the laws of the land or my parents, if it happens to coincide, that's just coincidental. But when I have an awe, a respect, a fear, then I am more inclined to do what they have asked me simply because of the feeling that I have for them, even though I might have chosen to go in a different direction. And so it is that we think with regard to our relationship with God, and we think of these proverbs, that we might likewise keep in mind in each one of these how important it is that a part of this is that we have a fear with regard to God. In conjunction with this, I would bring to mind a passage that I'm sure is reflected in a number of places, but certainly is there within the 55th chapter, in about verses 8 and 9 of the book of Isaiah, where Isaiah simply indicated that God's thoughts are not the same as man's thoughts and ways, and that God's thoughts are higher than man's. And hopefully we appreciate that and how it likewise fits in with regard to that of the fear of God. When we begin to look at such things as proverbs, though they may seem to be simple in many respects, at the same time, hopefully it will cause us to contemplate how God has in so many ways presented his word so that man has no excuse for not understanding and obeying it. Certainly, it goes to the very depth and beyond that of the full comprehension of man, as we never reach a point where we can say that we fully understand every bit of it and we can just recite it back. We'll spend a lifetime and could spend even longer of continuing to go into the depths of God's Word. And yet at the same time, it goes down to those things where any individual should be able to understand. And even the little child, as they're beginning to grow and beginning to grasp the instructions given by parents, they can grasp and understand many of the thoughts, the concepts that are being presented in God's Word. And so it is within the book of Proverbs as it reaches into the different areas of life, and it presents both those things that are shown to be contrasts and also those things that are compared, and relating it to the various events and people that we come in contact with, the various things that occur within life, then it helps to give us a better feel with regard to our approach to one another, our own thoughts, and of course our relationship with God. And as we contemplate even these things, we can perhaps appreciate just how little the Bible actually is. And many times I know that people look at it and say, well, you know, it's just so long, such a big book. And yet in reality, it is not. It doesn't even come close to the many books that have been written about the Bible. But when you think with regard to this as being God's law, and that which he has unfolded from the past as well as that of the present, we can see that really it is given to us in a very brief and yet a form that we can understand. Compare it, just in looking at our own nation, at the many laws, not only of the federal nature, but also the laws of the various states. And if you took, for example, the laws of the state of Texas and put them all together, do you think they would compile a book that would be shorter than the Bible? I think you know that they wouldn't even come close to being a comparison. There is no one that fully understands all the laws of the state of Texas, much less all the laws of this nation. Can't even come close, and so we end up with specialists in many different areas. And you try to contemplate even understanding the laws of the nation as contrasted with that of understanding God's law. And again, God has dealt with it far more simpler than man, and yet far deeper. You think for a moment with regard to the legislature or Congress bringing into existence a law which is ultimately passed, and how many times that one law within itself is going to be very lengthy. And then, as it is said, you don't really understand the law until it is tried in court. And so many times there's various aspects of the law that will ultimately come to the court, not all at once by any means. And there are times when what's being raised is the meaning of the statute or certain portions of it. And as that's being contemplated, they might dig back into the legislative history. And what happens this time is that the judge may ultimately say, I know what the legislative history is indicating, but the wording of the statute doesn't correspond with it. And as a result, I'm going to hold according to the way that it's worded. And if the legislature wants it different, they need to go back and amend the law. And you think of how times change, of what it was like a good number of years ago before there was an automobile. And as soon as there was an automobile, how many new laws might be required. And when you had the airplane, and now you had to deal with the law with regard to the space above a person's land and how far might the airplane fly and not invade your personal private airspace. And then came, of course, that of going into space itself and the laws between nations. And so on and on you can go with regard to the laws of man, the interpretation of it. And when you begin to look at the different things that come into the courts, and the standard that might be used with regard to proof. Is it going to be by a preponderance of the evidence or beyond a reasonable doubt? What kind of a standard are you going to use? And breaking down the elements of the matter that's under consideration. So when you come to God's law, we have that which remains. And over the years, it doesn't need to be changed, in spite of some who write at least to our local paper from time to time and say, well, we need a new Bible. Somebody needs to write a new one, as if any one individual or group of individuals could even come close. Obviously, they couldn't. This is a work of God and will never be excelled by mankind in any way whatsoever. And so it is, as we begin to look even further with regard to the book of Proverbs, and with chapter 17 and 18, and once again, as has already been pointed out, as you're getting into this area, it's not really one where you can so easily break it out as any number of verses that can be taken together as dealing with a topic, or where the whole chapter might deal with one topic. And as a result, I don't expect to get through even chapter 17, much less chapter 18, and there again you'll need to get the book. But look at some of the practical aspects that are being reflected within these verses. Beginning with verse 1, "Better is a dry morsel and quietness therewith than a house full of sacrifices with strife." And you just try to picture that kind of a situation. On the one hand, you have a family that is basically poor. They may be trying to figure out a way to put the food on the table each day. But at the same time, though they're having difficulty in making ends meet, they certainly don't live in a great house. Now, I'm sure you can go into cities such as San Antonio, and you're going to find communities that are just like that, not just one house, but a whole community, really struggling. And yet, if you go into that house and you're able to observe them, they are there in peace. They know they're struggling, but there is harmony. There is love. There is concern for one another. And so they are united in that type of a relationship. And so to speak, you may go across the tracks in a far more prosperous area, and you may very well then find a family, though they have the abundance of those things that relate to the physical life, and yet there is turmoil within. There's no happiness within the marriage. If they sit down to eat together at all and have children, they may spend their time quarreling. There is dissension, a lack of unity, very likely a lack of love. Now, which one do you want to be a part of? And I think we can appreciate, and we know that, as in so many of these cases, that we're not talking about absolutes, that you're going to find some poor families where there's nothing but turmoil, and you're going to find some of those that are more prosperous, that everything is bliss and happiness within it. But we do know that some of these rich families that are really rich, and the news comes out with regard to their history, their background, you find a multiple number of marriages and all the turmoil and the times they've had to be in court fighting over the different things, and then the children ultimately fighting over the inheritance and things of that nature. Would you want to be a part of that family? And what sort of reminded me of was to go back to the Christmas Carol and Scrooge. And particularly as he saw those ghosts from the past and the present and the future, he had moments from the past that were very happy for him. And yet he chose to lose those and give those up as he sought the wealth. But I think every indication is from the way he was living and the way everything was presented, I don't think he was a happy man at all. And yet when we went to the home of Bob Cratchit, then it was an entirely different situation. Very poor family. But there was unity, there was happiness, there was love. And of course we know how that story ended, but the same thing is still presented here. Which would you rather have? That dry morsel? Quietness? That peace, tranquility, love, unity, happiness? Go through life in that situation, or with an abundance and the lack of all of those good things that really make life worthwhile? I don't think there should be all that much difficulty in reaching a decision. And he doesn't have to in these cases. It's, I'm sure, intended to be obvious. Number 2, a wise servant shall have rule over a son that causes shame, and shall have part of the inheritance among the brethren. You can reach back into even the history of this country, and you probably don't have to go back all that far, but you can certainly go back even to our early days and coming on up to the present, and you'll find individuals who, in and of themselves, played a very important part in the history of this country. Maybe because of the position in government, possibly as the president of the country. Others who rose to great fame because of their wealth and their accomplishments otherwise for the nation. And yet they had children who didn't live up to that reputation. And we all recognize that in many instances, individuals who may have accrued a sizable amount of wealth themselves, it was soon gone after their death because of the manner in which those who inherited it used it. And so it is that, of course, we recognize that today we are not likely in this country to encounter this kind of a situation where this have the mention of the servant and ruling over the son. But certainly go back at the time this was written, and what came to my mind was that which we have over in the about the 24th, 25th chapter of Genesis. I think it's the 24th chapter. And this has to do with the account where Abraham sent his servant, one that was the ruler over his household, sent him back to obtain a wife for Isaac. And if you read the account, one thing is we know that he had some 10 camels. I don't know how many it took to make a big caravan, but he certainly had a small caravan. From that which he handed out to the members of the family, in the ways of gold and jewelry, he apparently carried a good number of wealth with him. And not only that, it's obvious from the context and even the words that's used, that he certainly had a number of individuals, of men with him. They had a good distance to travel. Abraham had to put a lot of trust in him. It would have been very easy for a man who really was only interested in his own personal wealth, however he looked upon it, to have simply disappeared. Perhaps the others would have followed him, taken the wealth, the camels, and just gone on his way. But we know that he didn't do it, that he got to the general area where he believed that Abraham's family resided, and he began to inquire of the Lord. Asked that the maiden that might show up, that she would speak in a certain manner. And Rebekah, when she did arrive, spoke exactly that way. And so they were soon united with the family there. They had no longer than taken the care of the animals, the camels. Then even before sitting down to eat, he said, "Before we do that, I need to tell you my mission." So that was the first thing. The next thing that we find is that they're wanting to stick around, wanting the daughter to stay around for a while. And this man says, "No, I've got to return." Here was the attitude of an individual, though he's some distance from his master, has such a great interest in the well-being. He's not just thinking of himself. He's wanting to do that which pleases his master. And that's exactly what he does to the very best of his ability. And so we can well understand, if you have that kind of an individual who is over your household, and yet you have a wayward son that you know is going to squander everything if it's left in his care, who do you want to give the responsibility to? Maybe even who do you want to really give everything to? But if nothing less, if very likely you'll want to give it to the servant to look after the son and continue to provide for him and not waste everything or allow the son to waste it. And so a wise servant shall have rule over a son that causes shame and shall have part of the inheritance among the brethren. And might we not want to do something of the same thing? If we have something to leave behind us, whatever it might be, wouldn't we rather leave it to those that will use it appropriately than just leave it, perhaps even to our own children, when we know very well it's going to be misused? What about the Lord with his relationship with us? And for that matter, in any kind of a situation of even a parent with a child, which one are you going to likely listen to? The one who is obedient, the one who is disobedient. The employee who comes making a request of his boss, that is a good employee versus one who is not, which one is likely to get his request answered? And I think we know the answer to that. Well, let's look at number 3. A finding pot is for silver, and the furnace for gold, but the Lord trieth the hearts. And perhaps you can get something of a picture here with regard to the process of purifying such metals as gold and silver and certainly others. And I don't know if any of you have any background at all with regard to that. Even before going to college, I'd gone through a trade school about 14 months to complete it on trade of printing. And we went with all the basics, you know, learning to set type by hand and part of the process, in addition to working the various presses and linotype and that sort of thing, was to melt the material that would make the type, the lead. And so you had a big pot, and you had a manner of heating it up and melting it, and you would skim off the scum that would come to the top. And the purifying process, if you want it real pure, you might go through the process several times. Well, you can get the picture here likewise. If you're involved with silver and gold and you want it to be extremely pure, you're going to go through that process over and over again until you have eliminated all of the impurities. Now, we can grasp that easily enough, even if we've never done it. But consider, on the other hand, the idea of God trying the hearts of men. What's he doing to the hearts of men? What's he wanting to do? Purify our hearts. And how is he going to accomplish that? Well, we know that the initial process is through his word. And that as we contemplate his word and we meditate upon it, and as we therefore then think upon those things that God says to think upon, and as we seek to obey him, and in this age, that of becoming a child of God, and as we do so, what's happening? Our lives are being purified, much like that of skimming off the scum from the top of metals. And so the process continues on and on throughout our life, a continual process of purifying. And from time to time, we know that the Lord may chasten us as a part of that cleansing process. And so it is that just in that same manner that we deal with the earthly cleansing and cleaning and purifying of metal, so likewise does God do with our hearts. Verse 4, a wicked doer giveth heed to false lips, and a liar giveth ear to a naughty tongue. And with a number of these, you suppose you might approach them from several different ways, but one of the thoughts that comes to mind with regard to this, the individual, and once again, you know, we're talking about the individual, not just the one who occasionally will say something or do something wrong or foolish. We all have done that. But thinking in terms of the individual, that this is their way of life. The wicked one. The liar. What kind of people do they associate with? Who do they listen to? Where do you find them? Those who have given their lives in that manner. I think that we recognize that they tend to associate with their own kind. Oh, I think on the whole, they know when they're lying. Some might get to the point where they believe their own lies, but generally, when they're lying, I think they know exactly what they're doing and why they're doing and what they hope to accomplish by it. The same thing if they're going to resort to some other form of evil. They know that they're breaking the law. They know that there's a potential of getting caught and the repercussions. And reminded me along with other things, I spent a couple of years working in one of the federal prisons as a guard, of course, and in the office. And I remember one of the prisoners, and has always stuck in my mind, I don't remember what he was in there for, but he indicated that he was willing to spend a couple of years in prison anytime if he could live the way he wanted to when he was on the outside. And you think of the kind of an attitude with regard to an individual of that nature and if what he was saying was true. What kind of associations is he going to have on the outside? What kind of people is he going to be with? Where are you going to find him? I think you know exactly the kind of people he's going to associate with. And so with the liar. And as a matter of fact, if you are that kind of person, I don't think anybody here would be, but I think that that kind of an individual, if they came into and had any association with those individuals, such as a believer associated here, where you're actually striving to live as a Christian, where you're here for the purpose of being present as we talk about the Scriptures, I think they would feel out of place, completely uncomfortable. And to bolster themselves in some way or other, and no doubt thinking they were right in doing so, they would probably criticize those who are here. Say they're hypocrites or some other terminology. And so it is that the wicked doer giveth heed to the false lips, and the liar giveth ear to the naughty tongue. Verse 5. Whoso mocketh the poor reproacheth his maker, and he that is glad at calamities shall not be unpunished. And I'm reading, by the way, from the King James Version, if you didn't already recognize it. You think with regard to this, and I suspect that it may occur perhaps even more often than we might think, in which someone who is doing fairly well, doesn't mean they have to be rich or even the category of being wealthy. It's just, you know, they're doing fine. And yet they see others who obviously are poor and basically looking down upon them. Much like Jesus speaking with regard to the prayer of the Pharisee and the publican and speaking with regard to those who trusted in themselves rather than in God. And so it is that what we may be inclined to forget is that God made both. Those individuals who are poor, they are creatures of God the same as those who are in positions of wealth or authority of any kind. And sometimes we may be inclined to forget it, and hopefully we recognize that down through the ages and including this present time, many, many people throughout the world are poor, not because of a lack of effort on their part, but because of the time and place and circumstances under which they find themselves, they're never able to get out of that poverty. And to look down upon them because of their being in poverty, God is not pleased with it. They belong to Him the same as those who have prospered. And James speaks with regard to something of this nature when he talks in the second chapter of James with regard to the two individuals that come into the assembly and how that we give more attention to the individual who comes in who is richly dressed as opposed to the one who comes in who obviously is poor, or at least gives that impression. So we need to be careful as to how we deal with individuals. But likewise, and perhaps we need to take more care with regard to this, that is being glad at calamities of others. And I have no doubt that within the lifetime of those who are here, there have been individuals who have suffered great calamities and death that perhaps much of the world has rejoiced at. There are those such as Stalin and Hitler, many in our more recent time who have been responsible for the death and destruction of many lives and property and upheaval of nations. And when those individuals are done away with, we may be inclined to rejoice. But we need to be aware that God takes no pleasure in the death of individuals, those who are wicked. It's God's desire and the very purpose of Jesus coming to this earth that all men might have and do have the opportunity of eternal life. So we need to leave the judgment to God as far as that of rejoicing or not rejoicing. Verse 6, children's children are the crown of old men, and the glory of children are their fathers. And I'm sure there are many here that recognize the significance of this. Grandchildren, indeed, how great it is for those whose grandchildren are growing up and are developing not only physically and mentally, but also spiritually. And even if the grandparents themselves have not been great in their lives from the spiritual standpoint, maybe they haven't even set a good example otherwise. But I dare say that they take pride with regard to those grandchildren who are growing up in the nurture of the Lord and how great they are. And so it is that they are indeed a crown. And what a greater thing to pass on to the next generation than to be able to look and to know from the scriptures that here your grandchildren are growing up to be very fine Christian men and women. What greater thing is there to pass on? It far surpasses any wealth. And so it is that you like to think in terms of likewise of the glory of children are their fathers. And I might hopefully wouldn't be expanding too far on that, saying and their mothers also. But even with regard to children where their parents are not what they should be, how often it is that at least while they're small, those children deeply adore their parents, even when sometimes they're being abused. And so it is how great it is and how much we should appreciate the manner in which little children will look up to and adore their parents. And when they think in terms of their father as portrayed here, and no doubt there's a time with many of them when as far as they're concerned, there couldn't be anybody who knows any more, who could do more than their father. We know that'll change to get older as they see the perfections and the lack of full abilities on the part of their father and their mother. But there's a time when they're the greatest in their life. Well, I think we've got a minute. 2 minutes. Okay. Obviously haven't gone very far. Excellent speech in verse 7. Becometh not a fool, much less do lying lips a prince. With regard to the fool, it's going to be the individual who obviously is known as a fool, and thus on the one or two occasions where they speak something that's wise, people are likely to shake their head and not believe it. But on the other hand, with regard to that of the lying prince, how much it is a detriment to all that are under them. And here, don't have to think in terms of an individual who is holding that particular position within a nation, but could be a person of any importance and holding a great position above others. And their lying lips, their conduct is that which is reflected down through the rows of individuals that are under them, and the various levels reaching all the way to the bottom. So let us continue to learn from the great wisdom of the book of Proverbs. Thank you.